court is ready to hear argument in 040477, Minnesota Life Insurance Company versus Maya L. Vasquez.
May it please the court. Minnesota Life is here today asking for the court to do one of two things. First, to eliminate the damages awarded as a result of the alleged knowing violations of the Texas Insurance Code, as the record contains no evidence that the insurance code was either violated or that that violation would have been in a knowing fashion. Alternatively, Minnesota Life asked the court to limit the amount of all recovery awarded, exclusive of interest and costs, to $75,000 if the trial court abused its discretion in allowing Ms. Vasquez to amend her petition post-verdict and thus delete her damage limitation clause.
If we agree with you on the first, we don't reach the second?
I believe so. Yes, Justice Rester. Each of these issues independently call back to concurrences and issues raised in concurrences by Justice Heck in earlier decisions. The first, the insurance code violation issue, refers back to the Giles decision. And the concurrence written there, and the pleading amendment issue refers back to the Greenhall issue, and the Greenhall amendment and the pleading issue raised there, the concurrence there. I'll address the insurance issue, insurance code first. This was an accidental death mortgage insurance policy. It's very clear that the policy definition excludes payment if the death results directly or indirectly from bodily or mentally infirmity, illness, or disease. Referring to years of Texas case law, the Fifth Circuit in Siegel versus in a Siegel case faced a almost dead-on point similar situation in which a heart condition caused somebody to fall, suffer blunt force trauma to the head, and die as a result of that blunt force trauma. In this situation, the facts are undisputed in this respect. Mr. Vasquez, the insured, had serious illness, both seizure diseases that induced a coma that lasted up to 12 days, and renal failure. We don't know exactly what happened to Mr. Vasquez, because he was in a separate room unwatched when he fell and hit his head and died. If, under Siegel, either the renal failure or the seizure disorder caused him to fall and die, it is clear that this would not have been a covered claim under the policy. There would be no payment due.
But you're saying the record, under the record that we, as we now know it, it is impossible to tell?
I think it is. It is impossible to tell. There was no decision ever made. And that ultimately resulted in payment for this reason, that unlike Siegel, as I understood the policy as it explained there, in this instance, that it was an exclusion for mental infirmity, bodily illness, or disease. If the medical records had demonstrated, in fact, that the renal disease or the seizure had been the cause of the fall, then there would have been proof for the insurer carrier its burden on the exclusion. Because there was no proof, however, that could let you know one way or another, it was a very close call. It would be fairly debatable, I believe, in the words that other jurisdictions use. I think this is a case that could have been litigated on payment without fear of bad faith liability for a denial, because it was that close.
Burden was on the insurer to prove the exclusion.
But the burden is on the insurer to prove the exclusion.
And if it's impossible, it's impossible to prove, you would have lost.
Well, I think there was circumstantial evidence that would have allowed us to meet that burden, but on the same hand, there would have been circumstantial evidence that it was a fall, blunt force trauma. Would have been up to a jury. That's why I don't think it would have been bad faith. But I think on a very close call, actually, either would have been a supportable jury verdict, but my recommendation would have been
independent. Was the circumstantial evidence meager circumstantial evidence where the jury would have to guess whether he fell because of the encephalopathy or whatever?
No, I don't think it.
What was the circumstantial evidence that was greater than meager, suggesting your client would have gone?
Well, that the with respect to, and again, this is all in hindsight. After we got the medical records,
I understand.
But there was a bite that was consistent with a seizure, a new seizure disorder, or a new seizure occurring. There was a bite on the tongue that is referenced in the medical records. There was the renal failure, which can result in weakness and falls of the type that was suggested. But we just don't know. There could have been water on the floor, too, that is consistent with
In determining whether liability is reasonably clear or not, should we, does the court look at the statements of Minnesota Life itself, its doctors, those who are saying it looks like this is an insured loss, we would like to further confirm, but at this time it does look reasonably clear that the cause of this was an accident?
2 points, Your Honor, one factual and one legal in response to your question. The first is, factually, the doctor, when he originally looked at the situation as opposed to the medical records, did not suggest it was an insured loss or an uninsured loss. He suggested that it was consistent with what had been described, and that was a very close question at the point. I think the doctor's deposition testimony in the record is clear that he doesn't decide whether it's an insured loss or not. He's there to talk about the medical facts and allow the claims examiner to decide whether those medical facts fit the policy. To Your Honor's legal point, that is exactly what recalls Justice Heck's concerns in the Universal Life Giles case as to whether you have to look at evidence that is supportive of a reasonable basis for denial when in fact you are engaging in a no evidence review. I don't see that there's any other way you can judge whether there is a reasonable basis without looking at evidence that is supportive of the decision. If there is no evidence of that, obviously there is no reasonable basis.
According to your brief, there was almost 5 months between when you first asked, when you received the claim, and when you were told we're not giving it to you without a signed authorization. I mean, you're client surely knew they were going to need a signed authorization to get these records.
Well, no, in fact, and this goes to the knowing conduct. The record is clear with respect to what we tried to accomplish, and the way we did it was we hired a service to obtain these records. The very first phone call, and there's a record of what the service told us about its communications with the hospital. And the very first, I'll get the record site on my break, but the service had a conversation with the hospital in which the hospital said no authorization will be needed. And that was what was reported to Minnesota Life. So whether that was right or wrong, that is the state of our knowledge. The court may recall there was that evidence was submitted for a limited purpose because it wasn't proved up being the service had.
At that point, you knew it was going to be 8 weeks, or there was some estimate of 6 to 8 weeks or something like that.
Exactly.
Wouldn't you have known that you could expedite this by simply getting a release and having those records in your hand within days?
No, Your Honor, I think that misstates what our understanding was, that it was going to be 6 to 8 weeks without the release, that the release would not expedite in any manner the release of the records. That instead, what was happening, and this was the testimony put into the record by deposition from the hospital workers, it was just taking that long to produce copies of the records. And 4 to 8 weeks, it seems like a long time to me. But at some point, I think the court has to recognize there are commercial restraints on what an insurer can accomplish.
Well, at least it seems like, do you have some obligation to call your insurer? You've got a statute out there here that says you've got a reasonable time to deny or pay or say you've got a reservation of rights. Why don't you pick up the phone and call your insurer to respond and say, we're having trouble getting the records. Can you help expedite? I mean, there was no communication.
Your Honor, factually, there was communication. We sent several letters. And there was
she to the wrong address.
Pardon?
To the wrong address.
Well, to the address that she had as a insured with us. And, in fact, I think she got those letters. It was still her house that they were being sent to. And there were telephone conversations with her family. She didn't speak English, so we didn't have a way to communicate that directly with her. But there was communications, and I don't think there was any dispute that she knew the reason for the delay was the ability to get the medical records. She testified that she went to the hospital to attempt to get the medical records, and she couldn't do it either. I mean, that's in the record. So to the extent that we have an obligation to notify them what is going on, I think that, one, we did, and, two, whether we did it in an effective manner is proven by the fact that she understood that she needed to get the medical records. And as I was saying, I think there are just commercial restraints that are placed on an insurance company that prevent being perfect every time. And the problem here is I agree that this was not a perfect claims handling. I believe that's borne out by the testimony of the company employee who said this is the longest it has ever taken us. But just because it is unusual doesn't mean that we knowingly violated a provision of the insurance code. And as the brief points out, regardless of whether we should have had the medical records earlier, liability could not be reasonably clear until we saw those medical records. So that prong of the medical of the insurance code could not have been violated because we paid within days after receiving the medical records. The other prong, as I've suggested, there's simply no evidence that we failed to affirm or deny coverage as that language means in the insurance code. Moving to the pleading amendment issue, I just have to say that this is violative and perhaps didn't say it well enough in the brief. The thing this violates most is Texas Rule Civil Procedure 1 for a fair procedure to be gone through here. All Texas Rules of Civil Procedure need to be interpreted in light of that rule.
But then this is... there would have been nothing wrong with what the trial court did but for the removal.
No, Your Honor, I believe that we have two complaints about what it did. One is the removal. The second is that the $75,000 limitation induced us to do several things. One is not try the case with more witnesses brought to trial. We didn't videotape and present deposition witnesses by trial. That's all in my affidavit. And our star witness wasn't at trial because she was ill. We had a reason for a continuance, and this relates to the removal, but we didn't ask for the continuance because that would have pushed us over the year time period and would have, in fact, put us in a position where they could freely amend. And we would rather take the risk on the $75,000 than on the unliquidated damages.
Have all those arguments been made in the Greenhall case, really?
In Greenhall?
Yes.
Well,
all of those. I mean, the character of the case was different. We didn't know we were going to be subject to so many, you know, so much money in exemplary damages. We would have hired more experts. We would have put on more witnesses. Well, and yet we, you know, permitted that late trial amendment there.
The arguments that I just raised were raised, but the Greenhall said there wasn't any evidence of them. So I think one distinction is there was evidence. The second distinction here is the loss of the federal forum. Which was not raised in Greenhall.
Would that have worked both ways? In other words, if the federal court had retained the case and the jury came back with a verdict beneath the jurisdictional requirement, could the reciprocal argument then be made that removal was improper?
No, because under the federal system, what is required for the removal is there be a controversy that amounts to $75,000. And it could be more or it could be less. And I believe there all the time in diversity cases, federal courts enforce judgments for less than $75,000. The controversy arises because there's a potential for a claim for more than $75,000. So if you have a valuation issue on a property dispute between citizens of different states, and one side says it's worth $50,000 and another side that says it's worth
$50,000. Or if you claim $1 million and get nothing.
Right. So.
But why shouldn't it work both ways? That's what I don't understand why. You know, the amount you plead is sort of an art, not a science. You don't know what a jury's going to do. And if you end up wrong in that estimate, why should it work differently?
I see my red light is on. Respond to the justice. First of all, it's that way because that's the way the federal system and the legislature and the courts in that system have decided it should work. And what we're asking is for this court, in an exercise of comedy, to give deference to that. The second thing is that the difficulty with prediction is exactly what the justice referred to. You don't know before a case. In this instance, the difference is there's a difficulty in prediction because it turns out to be only mental anguish damages. That's really hard to predict how you're going to value mental anguish damages. What this plaintiff did is said, regardless of what they are, I'm not taking more than $75,000 so I can maintain my preferred forum. That's her option to do it, but I don't see it is fundamentally unfair to help allow her to pick her forum in that manner and then say, but the reason beneath it no longer exists, so I'm not going to stand by it anymore.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Cliff Gordon will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The jury heard evidence in this case that Minnesota Life knowingly delayed payment of the claim, and in doing so, knowingly violated two provisions of the Texas Insurance Code. I'll start with the reasonably clear provision.
Counsel, let's move forward and talk about the damages limitation provision in your pleadings. The Court of Appeals talked about unfair surprise, but doesn't give any substantial or significant reasoning for not requiring a party that defeats federal jurisdiction based on its representation to a federal court to not be bound by that same representation on damages. Why should we agree with your position on that? I mean, you represent it to a federal district court, that limitation, and that was the basis of the judge's remand, Judge Jack, in his opinion. Why should that not be binding?
Well, I would disagree that that was the basis. Whenever a defendant is trying to establish diversity jurisdiction and remove the case, this is diversity removal jurisdiction, which is narrower than original jurisdiction. Law is clear that the plaintiff's choice of forum is preferred over the defendant's choice of removal. It's the defendant's burden, regardless whether the pleading is silent as to the amount claimed, or in a state like Texas, where federal courts recognize that trial amendments are allowed on damages, as in Green Hall, that those pleading limitations are not binding. And therefore, all that a defendant has to do is prove by preponderance of the evidence that the amount of controversy is met.
Well, the federal judge's opinion, I'll read from it, says plaintiff's state court petition expressly avers that the amount in controversy is less than $75,000. The only evidence Minnesota Life presented was a pre-suit demand for $110,000, and the federal judge cites case law where that's not sufficient to defeat jurisdiction. And the court finds there's a failure to establish subject matter jurisdiction in the federal court remanded. The basis of his opinion was your damages limitation provision in your petition. There were other arguments asserted, perhaps some other evidence, but clearly the basis was your damages limitation.
Again, I would disagree. It's the same burden of proof for a defendant, regardless. I mean, that's what both of the Aguilar cases say, 1 and 2 from the Fifth Circuit cited in our brief. When there's no amount of damages specified, the defendant has to prove by preponderance of the evidence the amount of controversy exceeds $75,000. And the same is true if there's an amount for less.
Okay. Well, let's assume that you're correct, that that was not the basis for the federal judge's opinion. the fact that that representation was made and argued in federal court. It could be part of the reason for the remand. You don't think you should be bound by that position and that representation?
Mrs. Vasquez never appeared in federal court. This was a sua sponte remand, which is also unappealable. We had no input whatsoever. I've been in front of Judge Jack, where the first thing that she asked the plaintiff is, are you going to forever limit your damages to less than $75,000?
She had incurred all of her mental anguish by then, right?
Yes.
That paid off the mortgage before she filed suit.
I believe that the service of the petition was on its way at the time that they paid.
And her mental anguish was solely because it took 6 or 7 months to get the mortgage paid.
I don't believe the record showed that she was continuing to suffer much beyond.
This is not a case where by the time of trial in the state court her damages had continued to accrue from the time when she said her damages were less than $75,000.
Well, actually, she did testify that into April, before she learned that the mortgage had been paid, that she still had concerns and was upset. That she still had not learned.
Remand was in May. So at the time when the federal court remanded because the controversy was less than $75,000, she didn't have any damages accrue thereafter.
I don't believe so. But also at the time that we filed the suit, I mean, it's a rather modest mortgage life policy. And early on, we don't know exactly how the insurance company handled the claim. We haven't learned yet that we're going to find out that they don't know about Texas law. We haven't gotten their internal notes yet that, like Chief Justice Jefferson intimated, it sure seemed like the insurance company was taking a position when they got it that this looks like an accident.
In terms of our review of this case, do you think the standard of review requires us to ignore the fact that they consulted with a doctor? They got the death certificate, autopsy report, asked the doctor Rich to review them, asked a third-party company, PMSI, to obtain the records, and ultimately when there's continuing problem getting the records, hired a lawyer to facilitate that process. Is all that irrelevant? I mean, can we just not consider that in terms of deciding whether their conduct was reasonable under the circumstances?
I think the standard of review, and I don't think there's a disagreement in the briefs over this, is that the court reviews the evidence, only the evidence supporting the verdict.
Of this is undisputed, though. The things that I just mentioned, you're not disputing that they took these actions. You say they should have taken earlier actions or additional actions, but you're not disputing that they did all of these in terms of trying to obtain the records during this five-month period.
Well, there was conflicting evidence on exactly what PMSI was doing.
But not that Minnesota Life hired them for the purpose of obtaining the records, or am I wrong about that?
No, that we agree with that.
So are you saying that we say we're writing an opinion on this case, we just ignore that all of that happened and look at the delay and instead, and that they could have done more than what they did, and that would be the basis of an opinion affirming?
I'm not sure you can take the evidence out of context, but to the extent that there's some evidence from which the jury could have found knowing violations, that's the end of the review.
But can we look at that evidence that I just mentioned and say there's no way a jury with these undisputed facts could determine that, or as a matter of law, we hold that under those circumstances, the plaintiff did not prove the insurance code violations.
Well, the way I understand an evidence point, I mean, if the contrary proposition was established as a matter of law, obviously there wouldn't be any evidence supporting the verdict or supporting the judgment. I don't think we're suggesting that. I don't see how undisputed, if there's, I don't understand how undisputed facts could preclude an insurance company from knowingly violating the insurance code as long as there's some evidence that that's what they did. And in this case, I don't believe that there are undisputed facts, even if the court were to take that position, that would defeat on no evidence grounds or any grounds the judgment on the knowing violations. And getting back to the damage, the so-called damage.
How soon did they have to hire an attorney to avoid a bad faith claim? How long can you wait to get them from the hospital before you have to hire an attorney and sue them?
In the abstract, it's hard to say. In this case, Minnesota Life had the so-called 10-day rule, the only rule that they would admit to having, and they didn't even make a decision to get additional records within 10 days. I mean, if you're making any attempt to meet your 10-day rule for paying claims,
so
you ought to be able to decide whether you need more information.
If an insurer has a goal to always do things super fast, faster than any other insurance company does it, if they don't meet their own internal goal, then that's bad faith. I mean, the effect of that is insurers are not going to have any internal goals, right?
Would be as slow as possible. I understand that, but when that's the only goal that they have, and they also admit that they know that delay is as bad as denial, they admit that they know that it's wrong to delay payment of the claim due to delays in their investigation. They were willing to wait indefinitely.
But if you're right, I mean, there are plenty of hospitals that are not going to get you the records within 10 days after you. We're going to have a lot more lawsuits by Minnesota Life because they're going to have to sue them all.
Well, I think if we were using the 10-day guideline as a strict liability statute, or strict liability standard, we might have that concern. But it's one of the factors in this specific to this case that provides the evidence that they knew what they were doing was unfair.
On what date did liability become reasonably clear?
It was on the date that they received the death certificate and autopsy report, and certainly no later than their doctor initially said that he believed that the autopsy report and death certificate were consistent.
Did the death certificate and autopsy report provide demonstrate a linkage or non-linkage between his medical condition and the fall?
It reasonably clearly showed that there was an accidental death.
And well, it says accidental death, but the next question is, did he fall accidentally or not because of seizure related to, the reason he was in the hospital or some other medical condition?
I mean, both of them say seizure disorder with encephalopathy followed by blunt force trauma to the head. That sounds like A caused B.
Well, in the Siegel case, the autopsy report or death certificate actually said that the heart attack was the probable cause. And in here, you just have a notation. He has seizure disorder. Later on, he has this accidental fall where he slips and hits his head. And the medical examiner had the option to choose natural causes as the manner of death and choose accident. And, of course,
but that's not what governs the policy. The policy says if the accident is caused by some other disease, which is not inconsistent with what the autopsy said. I mean,
well, Minnesota Life certainly didn't view it that way. I mean, in this case, talking to their group claims examiner, Jeff Halber, the supervisor on this claim, he said he recognized that at least parts of the death certificate indicated coverage. He had the authority to pay the claim at that time upon receiving the proof of loss, the death certificate, and the autopsy report, and that had he paid it then, and he was supposedly looking for a reason to pay it, had he paid it then, he wouldn't have been subject to any criticism. from within the company. And, you know, ultimately, I think Mr. Howland was trying to say that maybe this was a business decision, but no, they determined that this was, I mean, I think they said it four different ways. It was payable, it was covered, it was due, and it was owed. And the only thing that supposedly changed was the existence or non-existence of eyewitnesses. And that's not the investigation that they did. And this court in Simmons faulted the insurance company.
Well, on a $43,000 claim, you don't have to take many depositions for that's doubled, right?
True.
So we don't want a rule that says no matter what size the claim, you've got to start taking depositions. I mean, the cheapest way to investigate a claim like this is to get the hospital records.
Well, they could have gotten the medical examiner's records, and when asked, wouldn't you want the medical or the records that the medical examiner had in her possession that led her to conclude that this was an accidental death? Don't you think you'd find those important? Halber said, one would think so. But in this case, I mean, what we have is a delay-oriented investigation. I mean,
what's the motive for that? Well, I mean, it's delay, but this gets back to my other question. It's not exactly delay. I mean, from an early point after the claim arrived, Minnesota Life is taking action. You don't think it's fast enough. The jury obviously didn't think it's fast enough, but it was being done. So, I mean, was there any evidence that explained, from your point of view, why it was so slow? Was it intentional? Was it just to see if she'd go away?
Well, the evidence was they needed to use this records company because they had their people would be overwhelmed. The company just didn't have enough staff to handle all these claims themselves. I mean, I think Mr. Howland started his opening with that. And I'm not sure what motivation you need for employees of a large company to keep money in the company's pocket. I mean, these people were just hoping that this would, I mean, the jury could believe that they were just hoping that they would give this lady the runaround, but then the attorney shows up, who Mr. Halber says, it's in the record. Can you tell us, Mr. Halber, that this claim would have been, might not have been paid, that Mrs. Vasquez not retained a lawyer? Her claim might have been denied, was his answer.
When you have a 10-day policy of trying to turn around these payments, I don't quite understand why they would select this case to slow pay. I mean, there doesn't seem any explanation for that. And the use of PMSI, I mean, these companies exist for the purpose of obtaining records. Just simply using them rather than their own staff wouldn't seem to have any effect on.
Well, you know, motive isn't an element of the statute, but I think if we're delving into why they don't want to pay these claims,
there has to be some. If they're knowingly doing this, there has to be a reason for it.
I mean, they just don't care about a widow like Mrs. Vasquez. I mean, this is large company, they get these claims in, process thousands of them, they treat them however they want to. They have this 10-day rule out the window.
What's your evidence of that?
What's the evidence that they didn't care about Ms. Vasquez?
Well, as I started mentioning just a little bit earlier, Jeff Halber said he supposedly was looking for a way to pay this claim, and he wouldn't have been criticized if he paid this claim. He recognized that the proof of loss indicated coverage. Yet he decided to delay the claim.
What was the delay of communication with Ms. Vasquez? What was that about? I understand that there was some correspondence sent to her, and perhaps she didn't understand English and wasn't able to respond to the communication.
Well, it was my understanding that the problem was as a result of the letters going to the wrong address. I mean, she didn't. She testified that she didn't speak on the phone to Minnesota Live because she would get nervous, and I guess she wasn't comfortable in her English.
Did Minnesota Live have any problem communicating to her that her premiums were due?
I believe on this type of policy, the premiums are automatically deducted as part of the mortgage payment. So, I mean, Minnesota Life testified they knew that, you know, each month that they took to investigate this claim and get whatever records they were deciding to fish for, because it certainly looked like their doctor felt pretty confident that this, that accidental means of death was consistent with the autopsy report and the death certificate, and that further investigation would just be needed to further confirm. And then the subsequent note at that time, back in October of 2000, they're talking about, well, we might want to look at the circumstances of the hospitalization. Or they're just kind of fishing for information. I mean, they never specify that there's a particular issue that they're looking at.
Did you do any discovery to find out if there's a pattern of this company doing that?
We did. I don't believe that we did.
Any further questions? Mr. Counsel.
A couple of brief points. First of all, with respect to our earlier discussion, the references to the communications with PMCS can be found in the record at Volume 6, Defendant's Exhibit 1 and 31 through 33 are the page numbers. They clearly show in the entry for November 15, 2000, PMCS telling in Minnesota Life that no authorization would needed to be taken or gotten from the insured, and therefore if there is a violation, it couldn't have been a knowing violation based on that. I want to go back to Dr. Lee's supposed agreeance or agreement that this was going to be a covered claim. First of all, he doesn't decide whether it's a covered claim, but in the appendix to our brief, it's appendix tab E. And I took the trouble to have it transcribed because he's a doctor and he writes like a doctor. But it is the farthest from it. What he said is the fact the level of phenytoin, which was a drug used for the renal treatment, was low therapeutic would also be consistent with a seizure occurring with subsequent head trauma and encephalopathy. It's exactly what Justice Brisker was referring to. It's exactly what is on the death certificate. There are potentially two scenarios here, and this is consistent with the scenario that would have been in Siegel, which is the disease caused the fall. Now, what Mr. Halbert testified to at various times is that this also raises the possibility that the other scenario was there, and we don't deny that. All of this goes back to the Giles problem that Justice had announced in his concurrence and to what they argue today, which is you have to ignore this scenario where that leads to a reasonable basis for denial as well as payment. We admit there was a potential basis for payment just as well as a potential basis for denial. But if the court is going to, through the application of the no evidence rule, ignore the possibility, the very real possibility, that this should have been a denied payment at the time we were looking for the medical record, then there is just no way that we can get an appellate review of these type situations from a denied or a delayed claim.
What about the suggestion that you could have or should have gotten medical examiner's records and you should have contacted eyewitnesses or attempted to?
Well, first of all, the eyewitnesses, there weren't any eyewitnesses.
But you didn't know that. I mean, unless you tried to find out.
Well,
at what point did you try to find out whether there were eyewitnesses?
Well, there could be no causation was going to be my point with respect to eyewitnesses, because it was agreed at the trial that there just wasn't any, so that wouldn't have led anywhere. And I don't think you could get a causation analysis there. With respect to the medical records from the medical examiner, they were the same medical records. What they are suggesting is a different tact to get the same medical records. Well, Minnesota Life tried several tacks. They hired a commercially reasonable firm, and again, this goes back to the evidence that is undisputed but supporting us has to be considered, because I'll again refer to what I referred to in the brief. Their own expert said, I wouldn't pay this claim in October. Their own expert said that at the trial. He said, I'd go get the medical records.
But doctors obviously don't determine when a claims manager makes a decision on whether to pay or not. But Mr. Halbert, he was a claims manager. He made a determination that the claim should be paid. From that date, how long did it take for the claim to actually be paid?
Actually, Mr. Halbert didn't make the decision to make the claims payment. Ms. Brinkman did. Mr. Halbert, and can I finish my response? Mr. Halbert left the company before the medical records came in. Ms. Brinkman was the person we wanted to bring to trial but couldn't because of the illness. And so he didn't eventually make the claims payment. The point I was referring to, however, was not the doctor or a doctor expert on their side. They hired an insurance claims expert or somebody with experience in the field, and he basically agreed exactly with what Mr. Halbert's decisions were in October of 2000. And then when the medical records came in, the payment was made within days, I believe within 48 hours, because it was obviously on an expedited basis at that point. So the point is, this isn't a case about the decision that was made by Mr. Halbert. Their own expert agreed with what he did. The dispute is over the method through which we attempted to get the medical records. That's really the only real dispute here, and I'd suggest that given the commercially reasonable methods we attempted to get it through, the service and hiring attorneys and paying those people to do that, it cannot be unreasonable as a matter of law.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and all arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.